This is our Huye reading group. We are continuing our reading of Neo-Finalism. We're at page 107 of the translation. So this chapter is, the title is Absolute Domains and Bonds. And for him, these are sort of two coordinate concepts. So a bond is just anything that is, connects, one thing with another thing. He points out here that this sort of idea of connection at some point, like as you sort of like drill down into it, you have to get to some kind of absolute domain or this sort of absolute connection, which is not made up of, one thing next to another thing. One of his, wonderful sort of very concrete illustrations of some of these concepts, he talks about like gluing something to something else. So you can picture like, we have one piece of wood and a second piece of wood and you want to glue them together. Of course, you have to, put glue on one and then take the other piece and stick it onto the glued part. But then you could ask, what is connecting the glue to the wood in the first place? what is making this glue, stick to the wood? Of course, we know that you don't need a sort of second order glue or meta glue to make the glue stick to the wood. The glue just has that sort of immediately sticking property. The connection of A to B, in this case, first piece of wood and second piece of wood, by means of this third element, the glue, at some point has to sort of bottom out in something that is like immediately sort of self bonding. So in this case, the glue is sticky in itself. It doesn't require some, fourth element or fourth entity that would, connect it to the wood. And so this is sort of like his general, schema for understanding connections overall. Connection doesn't just mean, sort of two elements in space that are, connected to each other by a chain or a pulley or whatever. He can talk about connection between ideas between parts of an institution, for example, or, elements of an institution. These could also be connections. And insofar as there is this connection between these entities, whatever they are, it that connecting has to happen in this kind of absolute domain, this sort of self-surveying domain. So then we get into this little sort of excursus on metaphysics, which is a little bit sort of like scholastic. You can sort of picture medieval monks sort of commenting on this question, but like if you take an entity like a table has various properties, weight and surface area and so on, and you could ask, what is the relationship between the table and the properties of the table? So, the table has properties, whereas, of course, the table also consists of parts. For example, the surface, the tabletop and the legs are parts, or you could zoom in and take each, wood fiber is a part of the table, etc. But once you sort of take the whole collection of all the parts of the table, there's no, there's nothing separate from those parts that is the table. The table just is the parts. And so this is sort of related to Gilbert Ryle gives this sort of example of when he's like sort of introducing the concept of a category error, where you're giving someone a tour of Oxford University and you go to Trinity College and I forget all the other colleges, but anyway, you go to these different colleges and your guest says, okay, I've seen all the colleges, but where's the university? Of course, the university just is the set of all the colleges. And likewise, the table just is all of its parts. And so you have these sort of two coordinate ways of looking at the table, either as, this entity that has properties, the table is not its height or is not its weight. Those are two distinct, at least intellectually distinct, entities, I guess, in a sense. And they're connected with this relation of having. But at the same time, the table is its parts. There's nothing over and above the parts that is the table. And so these are sort of like two we sort of group together for our purposes. But in the case of a true form, this, having and being are sort of coordinate concepts that like a living being has its properties and is its parts sort of at the same time. Those are not two like distinct sort of metaphysical aspects of a living being in the way that they are for a table, for example. Yeah, so that's we're going to go into more of this when he talks about like what is the unity of a molecule in the next bit. But yeah, so like any sort of binding of entities always involves a kind of absolute domain that is sort of like the where the binding happened, or you know, in the case of like the glue example, the glue is sort of self-sticking. It doesn't need and it's sort of an absolute domain in that sense. It doesn't need an extra external entity to stick it to the wood, and this is sort of like the general schema for what is a bond in general. Okay, so we can pick up from 107. I think we're at the line, consciousness is indissociably...
I can read. Consciousness is indissociably both knowledge and binding force. Let us imagine that only a single man remains... Oh, wait, I think we have...
We did read that. I guess we're at we discover.
Okay, next paragraph. We discover similar results by following another order of considerations. As a unity in the multiplicity, an absolute domain or a true form realizes the otherwise inconceivable synthesis. Oh, wait, we did read.
Okay. Maybe I took down the wrong part. Maybe we should just pick up from there and keep going.
I think it's worth reading this dense paragraph. As a unity in the multiplicity, an absolute domain or a true form realizes the otherwise inconceivable synthesis of being and having. Is the system AB A and B, or does it have A and B as parts? Does the surveying unity have the details it surveys, or because the survey is purely metaphorical, is it the very totality of the surveyed details? The term to be signifies in this case to consist of, having as opposed to being only in this sense. If quote-unquote being is taken in the sense of quote-unquote proper existence, having will in contrast presuppose being. Ultimately, if to be signifies, quote, to consist of, unquote, the subject of the verb to be is only a linguistic convenience, because it simply designates the whole of its component elements. Because it is nothing by itself, it can possess nothing. A manufactured machine or a piece of furniture, like the inlaid table, does not float as a unity above its components. If the word table is employed as the subject of a predicative phrase, it would be a simple manner of speaking and an implicit reference to the machine or to the piece of furniture conceived by the engineer or the craftsman. In effect, the table was drawn as a table, that is, as the theme of a table, with determined traits that the craftsman selected. It is from domains of subjectivity that material objects borrow their unitary being and the possibility of quote-unquote having their properties. The absolute domains must therefore engender, on their own, the synthesis of the unity of being and the multiplicity of having. Is a water molecule, does it consist of, two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom? Or does it have, as its unity and being, three component atoms? We see straight away that this problem has the same solution as the problem of the bonding of elements and the partial loss of their individuality in the unity of the interacting system. According to wave mechanics, figure 35, in the schema of the water molecule, the wave functions of the three atoms partially overlap. Then an interaction energy appears. But this partial overlapping implies a partial loss of the duality of the electrons valences. This loss is gained by the molecular system, which is thus a genuine, and in this sense, quote-unquote, possesses the three atoms. If there were no zone of overlapping, the molecule would only consist of, or rather, there would be no molecule at all. Considered in their being and not merely observed, organic domains present a particularly typical case. In the course of mitosis, e.g. at the moment of the constitution of a spindle between two attractive spheres, does the cell have two poles of attraction? Or is it already two individualities? Passage from unity to duality has to be progressive, like the passage from prophase to telophase. Obviously, if the cell were merely a geometric objective domain partes extra partes, this progressivity would be inconceivable. The cell has to be an absolute form with self-survey to control the beginning of its own division, progressively diminishing the unity of the system for the benefit of its components. If it is a matter of a mitosis of development, the system's unity will not disappear completely, because a unique theme can be distributed to daughter cells, which would become, for instance, the right half and left half of the same organism. If it is a matter of a division of reproduction, the unity of the system will disappear completely. But this is perhaps only a semblance. because the two individuals of the same species can, or because the two individuals of the same species can eventually form a colony. If it is a matter of two identical twins, they might sometimes be mirrored, as though they were at once two individuals in the two halves, right and left, of a single individual. One, quote-unquote, has a right half and a left half, but, quote-unquote, one eventually could, quote-unquote, have been two individuals or nearly two individuals, as in the limit cases of division, where the duality is discreetly marked only by the splitting of the nose and the third eye, figure 36. Passage from a domain of absolute survey to two domains, even if they are presumed to be still connected to a specific unity, is of course enigmatic. But if we do not posit the notion of, quote, domain of absolute survey, unquote, the quote-unquote having, or the quote-unquote being that has properties, in contrast to the being that merely, quote-unquote, consists of, will be nothing more than an empty word, or, if we want to realize it, a contradiction in terms. The example of the water molecule, I mean, this doesn't really seem to be, not sure if he's making a new point here. It seems to be kind of the same thing as the covalent bonding example that he gave earlier in the chapter. But in any case, the loss of individuality of the individual atoms in their sharing of their electrons results in a gain in individuality at the level of the molecule, which seems to constitute the absolute survey of the molecule for Rouillet. Yeah, he acknowledges that it's mysterious or enigmatic, you know, how exactly a unified domain can split and become two separate domains. So if a cell divides itself, daughter cells, presumably that original cell sort of no longer, it dies basically, like it no longer has its own unitary existence. How that passage happens is it's not totally clear, but if there isn't a unity to begin with, obviously, you know, it can't divide itself into two separate unities. If it's a mere aggregate, you just end up with other mere aggregates, and their unity would only in the perceiving consciousness of the scientist. There wouldn't be unity to the cell in itself. And incidentally, Bataille has a interesting discussion of cell division in L'Érotisme in the beginning. He talks about continuity and how Bataille is interested in this moment of, he basically says, you know, there has to be a moment at which there's a shared interiority, the cell that's dividing and the cells into which it is being divided. And that kind of unity of inner experience is you know, sort of a foundation of the sacred for Bataille. So kind of an interesting, we're sort of interested in the same enigmatic transformation.
Yeah, the case of cell division is interesting because it's not clear whether we should say that the cell, after, you know, the cell that undergoes division dies in that division, or whether that cell is still living in in the daughter cells. It's our sort of our concept of like an individual living being doesn't apply in a very clear way to these single-celled organisms that are just dividing, and you know that lineage is, you know, like any bacterium living today, that lineage has, you know, been unbroken for a billion years or so. So you could in a way think of that as like one living being that's a billion years old, but also you could think of it as, you know, this bacterium is the result of this cell division. It might only be like 10 minutes old, and it's not clear which of these, it's not clear that one of them is better than the other. One way of thinking is better than the other. But yeah, so in the case of, like, so when he's talking about bonding here, the point of this example is to sort of contrast with the case of like a machine, for example, or a table, any of these entities that are, you know, produced by humans or by some sort of external party. In the case of take the table, for example, the table is sort of given a unity by the person who has this, you know, idea of a table or design for a table, even if that table is only ever sort of designed in the process of making it. And then it just sort of exists, as that table entity. Whereas in the case of the cell, the cell, of course, has a design, not in the sense that a person or, you know, a conscious being sort of drew up the plan for the cell, but it has, you know, a structure that is not just sort of arbitrary. But the part of what the cell's sort of design is precisely that it will undergo that division and produce daughter cells. And then, you know, in each case, the sort of design of this individual cell is the result of division of some prior cell. And so even in sort of like the history of the entities in question, the table is quite different than the cell with where the sort of production of this individual, in the case of the cell, is part of the sort of functioning or, you know, activity of this type of entity in the first place, whereas a table, of course, is not doesn't result from a prior table. Even if someone, you know, uses a table as a model to build a second table, it's that person who has the sort of overview of the table making process that, you know, decides I'm going to make a second table and, you know, assembles the materials and, you know, puts them together in the right way to make a table. Whereas in the case of the cell, it's the cell itself that has this sort of cell producing activity within it.
Yeah, I really like this part, and I mean this part was really anyway. So, like, you know, my with my background in cell biology, I've always the thing this fundamental concept of the cell has always been something for me that I feel like is one of the sort of fundamental issues with much of cell biology and neuroscience as a whole, which is how we conceive the cell. And you know, I mean, if you look at just a picture of a cell, you see all of these different parts, right? You know, the nucleus, you've got your ribosomes, you've got this, you've got that. But I, like as a grad student, I did research on organelle biogenesis. And, you know, there was, I argued with my, honestly, with most of the people on my committee, and it was, you've got one thing, you know, that sort of turns into another thing or fuses with another thing. And you've got all of these parts that are kind of interacting and exchanging. But the way I looked at it, and there's quite a few, once I started talking to people, there's other people who see it this way, is there's really no singular entity in the cell. It's just everything is constantly fusing. And basically what we are calling, you know, stable entities are just because we're just like freezing a point, you know, in space and time and saying this is what that is. But those things don't actually exist. And I think that's sort of what he's getting at here, which is that this has to be a totality. The cell has to be a totality. And then even in the division, it's not that you have, you know, you've kind of split these two totalities. It's a singular totality that is just kind of becoming, you know, dividing itself and just becoming two new totalities. But it's the same thing in a way. And that these aren't just, you know, it's not just a couple of centrosomes that form and pull some DNA apart. And now let's put a new plasma membrane around ourselves. And all right, we've got two new cells. There's no new entities really generated here. It's the exact same thing. And to me, like if you sort of stretched out our spatial temporal view of cell division, it would be the same thing that's happening inside a cell at any moment in time, which is just this constant mixture of everything. And if we could actually view all of this like at a higher speed, sort of, that's what we would see, is just this kind of, you know, kaleidoscopic array of chain. But it's just because of how we, you know, our perspective, that we see these as sort of these nice organized singular entities. So I don't know. I don't know if that makes sense, but to me, I mean, this is Yeah, and I think it's important that we do have that conceptual understanding of these things. And it kind of goes back even to how he, I think it was the last chapter when he was talking about the visual system. And you think, well, can you localize this internal visual sense to an area in the brain and say, oh, it's in this part of the brain that this image arises. That just can't be. I mean, maybe that area of the brain is an important hub for a lot of different inputs and different interactions that are critical to that sense. But that sense is a total, like he's been saying, it's an N, it's not an N plus one. This is a totality at all times. So hopefully that makes sense, what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, so like in the cell, of course, you have, yeah, many different sort of subsystems that do various different things, mitochondria and ribosomes and so on. But yeah, the cell is not a machine. It's not, made up of these components that are just sort of like already there, that are just assembled in a certain way. The cell produces itself, and by virtue of producing itself, it's producing all these sort of components as well. So if we were to compare a cell to a machine, it would be like a machine that produces its own parts that you sort of maintain it in good repair at all times, which of course none of our current machines do, which is probably a good thing, I guess. This is a very different type of entity than, a machine that is sort of the realization of an external idea that a person, decided to put these parts together in this way, has to constantly sort of monitor from the outside that the machine is functioning as designed, make repairs and swap out defective parts and so on. The functioning of a cell does all those things, sort of autonomously within itself. It doesn't require an external monitoring and, swapping in of external parts. That's just sort of like a very straightforward way of understanding this contrast between this sort of externally assembled machine versus the cell that produces itself and keeps itself in existence, over time without having to, without having to have like parts swapped in as it gets older or something like that.
Yeah, I wish I had a really like direct way to kind of explain this. It's always hard because this is early in the morning for me and it's a Sunday morning. So it's like, but the way I kind of, one way to think about it might be, and this is like for me, even inside a cell or even, inside the brain, when people might try to localize different function within the brain but I would argue it's a totality at all times. A kind of analogy here might be like, say, a symphony. And so you're hearing this, the entirety of the musical piece. But at any one time, there might only be like the string section playing, or maybe you have the horns over here, or maybe one section is playing the melody. And if you were to really focus in on that, you could say, okay, that's the musical piece right now. But really, if you pull back, it's part of the whole at all times. And by itself, it couldn't possibly be the musical piece, right? And so I think we sometimes have a tendency to say, oh, okay, well, I study the string section and I study the horn section, and we give too much weight to those areas and start to kind of pull those out as singular entities and lose that conceptual understanding of the importance of the whole, and that you couldn't have this symphony if all you had was this over here. And also, yeah, the strings are important, but they're playing off of things that are happening elsewhere, with other musicians. This melody that they're playing, if it was played on their own, it would sound a lot different than it does even if another section is now silent, or playing. I don't know if that makes sense, but yeah, I just, yeah.
Yeah, the symphony example is a good one, I think, here, because you could sort of imagine that, you know, you're at the concert and you're listening to the orchestra play, that you could imagine that, like, your sort of experience of the symphony is just made up of, like, your experience of, you know, the first violin, like, you're hearing the first violin and then the second violin and, you know, the flute and, like, each individual sort of instrument, you're hearing just each of these instruments, that, like, you have, like, an experience of each of these instruments that is somehow combined together. And, of course, that's not what is really happening. It's even, you know, it takes, like, practice and skill to be able to pick out one specific instrument and, you know, follow what that instrument is playing over the course of a symphony. You get this sort of, like, overall sort of experience or impact of an orchestra playing all together. And of course, it's not as just a sort of, like, undifferentiated, homogenous mass of sound. You can, you know, pick out, okay, here's what the string section is playing, or here's what the horns are playing. But at the same time, you're only hearing the horns, like, sort of against the background or in the context of what the strings and everything else are playing at the same time. So it's not just, it's not just that you're sort of hearing each individual instrument and then combining those experiences, those sort of, like, sound experiences together. You have this sort of single but complex and structured experience of the whole orchestra playing, and you can sort of move your attention from one sort of aspect of that experience to another. You can focus on one instrument or one section. But yeah, it's a very different type of sort of unity, like the whole orchestra playing together, that your experience of that orchestra is a very different unity than the unity that makes up, you know, a bicycle, where, you know, you have each part sort of next to each other, and you know, they all are sort of connected to each other in various ways to produce a certain type of effect that is desirable. The orchestra is not connected, you know, the whole sort of each of the instruments or each of the performers in the orchestra are not connected to each other in the way that the parts of a bicycle are.
Yeah, he so Ruyer in the section that at the beginning of the section that was read this morning, at the bottom of page 107, you know, where he's saying that you know, the subject of the verb to be is only a linguistic convenience, because it simply designates the whole of its component elements. Because it is nothing by itself, it can possess nothing. And I think that kind of gets at what I'm trying to say is, you know, that this this surveying unity that he's talking about is nothing more than the whole of its component part, you know, and that without, and maybe that's kind of what he's getting at here with this, the water molecule, is that that the water molecule isn't any of the individual elements, you know, either of the hydrogens or the oxygen, that it's the whole, it's now the water molecule. So, and we can, you know, we can look at it as two parts hydrogen and two parts oxygen if we want to, but as in his concept of this surveying unity, that's unnecessary.
So that passage that you just pointed to on 107. So that, in that case, he's specifically referring to the type of unity that say a table or a bicycle has. So the bicycle is just identical to all of its parts. There's no bicycle form that is sort of distinct from the collection of the parts, except insofar as, you know, a person or, you know, a conscious being of some kind is sort of you know, considering the bicycle as a unity, or, you know, it has a design for a bicycle in mind when they're, you know, assembling the bicycle in parts together, etc. You know, there's nothing sort of for the bicycle that makes it a unity. Whereas in the case of a living being or or any true form, you know, like in the case of the hydrogen molecule, the sort of the unity is sort of active in the molecule, in the sense that the hydrogen molecule is not simply the water molecule is not simply a hydrogen atom and two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom that are just sort of there next to each other. It's only when they are bonded with each other in this specific way that they make up a molecule. And here the sort of the unity is not just sort of in the eye of the beholder. It's not just I as the observer who, you know, picks out these specific atoms and decides to, you know, call that a molecule, or it's, you know, that, you know, sort of externally, you know, put little molecular chains on them to sort of connect them together. It's sort of intrinsic to the nature of the molecule that it is bound, that the atoms that make it up are bound together in this specific way, and that the molecule has this sort of self-survey property to it, in the way that the bicycle doesn't. So these are sort of two distinct types of unity, this sort of active intrinsic connection, or just sort of externally the sort of extrinsic being put together by something external.
Yeah, definitely. So right before at the beginning of that paragraph, there's the sentence, as a unity in the multiplicity, an absolute domain or a true form realizes the otherwise inconceivable synthesis of being and having. So maybe I'm not thinking of that. Maybe I'm misunderstanding what he's saying there, but the way I'm understanding it is he's saying that those two things are the exact same thing, being and having. You know, what it consists of is what it is.
I wouldn't say necessarily they're exactly the same thing, but they're, in the case of a true form, they're sort of coordinate concepts or two sides of the same coin, I guess you could say.
Right. Yeah, and so you could see it from either, I mean, potentially, you know, look at it from either side of that coin.
Exactly. So yeah, like in the case of the cell, like we were talking about, the cell, of course, is not just sort of a undifferentiated blob. It has all sorts of, you know, components that have various structures and functions. But at the same time, it's not just sort of assembled out of these like components that would be sort of externally, you know, just lying around next to each other. The cell sort of makes itself into these components. It differentiates itself. It produces these components in this like very structured and systematic way. So looking at the cell as like a collection of parts, on the one hand, this is not like wrong. It's not sort of a mistake. Mm-hmm. But it's also only sort of one side of what the cell is.
And you can't just favor that perspective or, you know, see that as the only
perspective. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, like the other side, of course, is that the cell is, you know, producing all these components and, you know, exists by means of that sort of continual self-production of the components in this, you know, pattern and structure and structured way. As opposed to the bicycle that just, you know, is a collection of parts that doesn't, you know, do anything. Like the gear shift doesn't, you know, care. There's nothing, doesn't affect the gear shift in any way, whether that gear shift is actually connected to a gear. It's just there. Whereas, of course, you know, the various, you know, organelles that make up a cell, like, I mean, they don't care in the sense that it, you know, they have feelings, but it does affect what they do and how they operate, whether they're sort of in a cell or just extracted and sitting, you know, I don't know, in a test tube or something.
Yeah. And so I guess, so that's great. So that's kind of where what I would get at is if you're seeing this in a certain way, these things exist to us because we freeze the cell, we fix it, we look at it. But that it's the cell itself that's guiding all of this, and that these aren't necessarily, you know, entities that arise and are like, okay, you do this, you do that. That it's more, these are things, these are events that are happening inside the cell at any one, you know, moment in time. And that you know, the component parts of these are all shared. So all of the components at this particular moment in time may be, you know, an early endosome, but at another point in time, maybe these are a lysosome, but they've, you know, they've mixed with a few other things slightly differently. And that the cell as a whole, as this sort of absolute domain, is directing this symphony of parts. So it would almost be like with my symphony analogy, if, you know, if now the string section could kind of you know, combine with the horn section, you know, to do something else. So it's directed as a whole. And it's not directing individual component parts. It's just allowing these things to arise and dissipate, you know, in instantaneous moments in time. And you know, it almost has to be this way. You know, so if you think about, say, synaptic communication, so you have a synaptic vesicle recycling. So this is also another project I had at one point in time. You know, and we tend to think, okay, you've got your postsynaptic cell that has these transmembrane receptors, and your presynaptic cell that has some synaptic vesicles, and you know, they take up some neurotransmitters, they release it into this synaptic space, it gets taken up, maybe you recycle here, and that these things are just always kind of sitting there. I imagine it more as like, and even the synapse itself is just this flux, is in constant flux, like you know, just kind of forming and deforming, arising here in this moment, arising there in that moment. All of the different components, the synaptic vesicles, it all comes together, you know, poof, spills it out, and then maybe you have some others come along and stuff. And it's not just these things that are kind of sitting there. They do their thing. Maybe another one comes up. Maybe it finishes doing its thing. It comes back up there to do it again. So I don't know.
Yeah. Sorry. I don't want to spend too much time on this one section. So I'm going to suggest we move on to the next bit here. Just getting where we were. Organelles, would you want to read from the metaphor of possession?
Sure. The metaphor of quote-unquote possession is instructive. If we consider the objective aspect of the fact, then the possession of a table, of a machine, or of a house will only designate a conventional series of acts, even independently of the juridical convention of property. And psychologically, the fact that the table, the machine, or the house appears as a familiar sensation in consciousness gives the possession an absolute and immediate reality, and thereby the possession always modifies the possessor in its being. The quote-unquote proprietor, or as J. Galsworthy says, quote, the man of property, end quote, is a well-known type of man. To have a visual sensation is simultaneously to be. The sensory cell's individual activity is not lost in ensuing global and massive unity, because the details of my sensation depend on this individuality and remain distinct in the surveying unity of the absolute surface. Quote unquote, I possess this sensory activity, and my possession totally transcends the possession of an object through an external relation. I participate in it. I am modified by it, while remaining distinct as a metaphorically surveying unit. Quote unquote, being having simply designates the domain of survey and the mode of bonding of parts in an absolute form. It would be obviously absurd to imagine that a molecule's mode of unity is the same as an organism's, and that the fusion of primordia in the case of the accidental abortion of the median embryonic primordium is the same phenomenon as the bond of formation of homopolar molecules. The differences are manifest, but this is all to say that at the root of these two problems lies a common given. The various mysteries we have encountered converge in the primary mystery of the form in itself.
Yeah, I think an interesting sort of side... I'll just make this point, and I'll let you come back in. An interesting sort of side element here to what he's talking about is the word ousia in Greek, which is translated as either substance or essence, depending on the context. This is like Aristotle's word for substance. So this is like a sort of self-subsisting entity. The sort of everyday meaning of that word in Greek, like not as a technical term in philosophy, was property. So, you know, when you sort of talk about, you know, this house is my property, or this person owns a lot of property, you would use the word ousia. And so here we see that, this metaphor of possession is sort of at the origin of one of the sort of most fundamental concepts in Western philosophy that then, of course, you know, has a multi-thousand year history and changes its meaning over time, etc. But we can see this sort of property relationship or the having relationship being sort of like coming up again and again as like a schema or a model to understand like what is what it is that we're talking about when we think of like an entity having attributes or having properties. Yeah, Angus puts in the chat here that's it. And you can think of also of like the Kant's transcendental deduction coming from Prussian real estate law. Yeah, like Kant has a very I don't think he ever did any like work as a lawyer or I don't know if he ever studied law, but yeah, you can see a lot of it is like he always talks about like the courts as like his sort of imagery is always of a court making a decision like in accordance with a certain principle. Like there has to be this principle that the court has to appeal to when it makes a decision. It's always interesting to try to like these very sort of abstract concepts and ideas sort of like connecting them to this very specific social institution like a court or a real estate registry or something like that that is sort of like the image that the person has in mind without maybe necessarily even knowing that's what they're thinking of at the time.
So Angus here in the chat, the quasi individuality of the parts as a complement to the surveying individuality of the whole. I definitely read that here. So my question is, he seems to be getting at exactly this over the last few chapters is, but where does that surveying individuality, that surveying unity begin? Does it just arise within each of these parts, sort of de novo, or is it a part of that original? Which I think he says something here that it does kind of diffuse that unity sort of diffuses itself across it, the new entities, like to the new. But if you start following this line backwards, where does it begin? Sort of,
Yeah, this gets into all the kinds of like even I guess theological questions about like where does the sort of unity of the universe come from? And he does. There is a chapter I haven't actually read ahead this far, but there's a chapter later on that has the chapter 20 of the book is the theology of finality. So I guess we will in that chapter at least hear something about that. But for now, I guess we can just stay tuned.
Yeah, we were talking about Simondon earlier. I'm trying to think if Rouillet has so far really talked about the origin of true forms, like how they come about. Nothing is coming to mind, but Simondon is obviously he's very concerned with that question, and his account of resolution of a metastable tension into some equilibrium state starting from singularity, I think is a helpful complement to Rouillet here. Although even if you might be able to read Simondon as because of the proximity and the complementarity of some of his concepts to Rouillet's concepts, as a panpsychist ally or pan-experientialist ally, he doesn't really talk about the experience of a crystal crystallizing or anything like that. So there's a bit of a distance between them.
Yeah, and it's also sort of, I think, connects with one of the sort of difficulties that difficult points that we came across when we were reading Simondon's individuation book is when he's talking about the crystallization process, which is, of course, his sort of like central example of individuation. The crystallization always sort of arises from this singularity. And so like you have, for example, like the sea crystal or, even like a grain of sand or something around which the crystallization occurs. But then, of course, the question is like, where does this sort of first singularity or this, where does that grain of sand come from? And you could have like a a sort of prior crystallization, and then, you know, one of these crystals sort of is the seed around which another crystal, you know, forms, etc. But, you know, eventually you're sort of like left with, you know, you need to have that sort of chain start somewhere. And like at one point he talks about like sort of chance, like as a sort of starting point of this crystallization, but then he sort of like seems to not really be happy with that idea that like the individuation would have its origin in a sort of chance, sort of singularity. But he doesn't really give an alternative to this idea. So yeah, it does seem like this sort of like, where does individuation start, or where does this true form start or come from, is sort of like a recurring problem in this sort of, you know, I don't know, tradition or sort of loose school of people, you know, that we've been reading. Okay, so yeah, I think we can keep going into the next chapter here. Read a few pages. Okay, so I'll read the next bit. So we're starting chapter 11, Absolute Domains and Finality. The general traits of the absolute domains we have examined are the conditions of finalist activity, but they are not finalist activity itself. By contrast, the traits we will now study blend with finalist activity as we have described it. So he's going to give a list of these traits here. So A, thematic forms. In an absolute domain, there are no stereotyped patterns. There are instead true forms, which, as it were, follow and recognize one another in their various aspects. Already in organic development, as we have seen, a muscle, quote, knows its name, unquote, according to P. Weiss's picturesque theory. In the order of instinct, the forms that concern nausea and praxia in the Umwelt are, quote, unquote, recognized. They do not function mechanically like keys in a latch. The experiments of animal psychology have also shown that for the chimpanzee, a baton, for example, is not an optico-geometric pattern, ne varietur, but, quote, any prehensile elongated object. In a behavior guided by the consciousness of values rather than by needs or instincts, the forms are also recognized according to their relations with the intended values, or inversely, the values are recognized through the forms. If I test various keys on a latch to identify the quote-unquote right one, the value will not be tied to the form proper, but to the pattern of the key. This limit case is obviously just a degraded case. The absolute forms directly disclose their various values in all the orders, technical, theoretical, aesthetic, etc., without a point-by-point confrontation between two structures. To use the Platonic metaphor, an absolute domain is a kind of mirror with reminiscence in which a transspatial projects and recognizes itself. An absolute form is at once structure and idea, eidos in the double sense of the term. The triangle, for instance, is at once spatial and quote-unquote ideal. A triangular pattern serving as the key to a photoelectric screen has to be strictly defined in space. The same is not true for a triangle. If it is a figure on the ground of an absolute domain, then insofar as it remains within the limits of its quote-unquote ideal definition, it will always be quote-unquote recognized as a triangle, regardless of its purely spatial pattern. To use more modern terms, but terms essentially equivalent to the Platonic language, the absolute domains enable a quote eidetic analysis unquote and make it possible to discern the world of values and of essences through the spatial-temporal world. I'll stop here because we have a list of points here. So yeah, maybe a good example of this sort of distinction is the famous Kanizsa triangle optical illusion, where you have three dark circles on a white background, and then you cut out like a wedge of each of those circles in such a way that it, like when you look at the circles, you see a white triangle over top of the three circles. Like, yeah, the wedges are cut out in such a way that it you know, sort of draws the sides of a triangle, even though in reality, or sort of on the page in terms of like physical space, there's no white triangle there. It's just like a sort of circle minus wedge arrangement, but you see the triangle there. So in this case, the triangle form is sort of present to you as a perceiver, even though there's no sort of physical line on a page that is a triangle. And so here, yeah, so in this case, the sort of triangle form is like unlocking a pattern in your sort of perceptual apparatus, even though it's not actually a physically, you know, present arrangement of ink on a page or something like that, that is that corresponds to that triangle pattern. Yeah, so this is sort of like his general concept of a thematic form is this arrangement that is not reducible to just like a spatial temporal pattern that would be sort of like, you know, this color patch is, you know, so many millimeters away from this other color patch or something like that. It's this, you know, structure. And this is all the sort of like gestalt psychology stuff that, you know, how, you know, you can recognize, you can train the chicken to, you know, recognize that the food is at the lighter of the two gray panels, you know, regardless of what actual shades of gray you're using. It's always the lighter one, even if the lighter in one pair is darker than the dark in another pair, it will still, you know, select the right one. So here, yeah, this sort of like abstract pattern of, you know, lighter shade of gray is something that the chicken can learn to recognize. Even though, of course, you know, there's nothing sort of like physically about this one shade of gray that makes it lighter, independent of this sort of arrangement of, you know, it's only lighter in contrast to this other shade of gray that is darker. The chicken is not sort of responding to like the wavelength of light that is, you know, striking its retina. It's responding to this abstract pattern of, you know, lighter shade. So yeah, this is sort of like his general concept of thematic form, which is largely borrowed from Gestalt psychology.
Yeah. Another interesting example of this, I was recently reading Paul Churchland's Plato's Camera. And in one section of the book, he's arguing against indicator semantics with the idea that like concepts are like reliable indicators of, you know, the presence of certain distal objects in the way that, you know, the height of mercury in a thermometer is a reliable indicator of temperature. But he says this, you know, it doesn't really make sense to think of perception in these terms, and that there are no laws of nature that allow us to like recognize a sock, for instance, as a sock. Like there are causal effects, you know, the light striking the retina, of course, when you look at a sock, but they're very diffuse and contextual, and the neural activity is very high dimensional, and it would be difficult, not possible practically to distinguish between the effects on the perceptual apparatus, you know, including all of the conceptual determination for the perception of a sock versus like the perception of a glove or something like that.
Yeah, we just have to appeal to the reminiscence of the Platonic form of the sock. That's how we distinguish socks from gloves. But yeah, like this is sort of like one of the problems that has come up in sort of like AI research, where you know, there was, of course, this ambition that you would be able to sort of like, you know, just basically give like a list of properties that, like, you know, you can recognize a sock in a photo because it will have properties A, B, C, etc. And that, of course, turned out to be pretty much hopeless. And, you know, I don't know if anyone's ever done this. It's probably not that useful, but you could pretty easily, I think, train like a computer vision system to recognize socks. Well, actually, it might not be that easy, because, of course, a sock is sort of like a flexible object that has various shapes depending on, you know, it could be rolled up, it could be crumpled or, you know, elongated or whatever. But anyway, like all the sort of successful computer vision systems, you know, like optical character recognition or facial recognition, all these things, like they don't rely on sort of like someone analyzing a picture intellectually and deciding, okay, the properties that make something a human face are A, B, C. It's you just sort of feed in like these millions of pictures of human faces and then other pictures that don't have human faces, and you get you sort of you know, with the label either face or not face, and you know, sort of allow the system to detect the patterns that make up, you know, that allow the system to sort of recognize a human face in a reliable way. It's sort of a black box in the sense that, you know, it's just a, you know, weighting of many like millions of nodes in a neural net. There's nothing you can sort of look at and say, oh, the system like you know, identified properties A, B, C as like essential properties of what makes up a human face. It's just this like, you know, many millions of nodes with various weights that have the effect that the system is capable of recognizing faces. You know, sometimes you can sort of reverse engineer and like identify, you know, this property is like important to the sort of ability of this system to recognize faces, and this other property is less important, etc. But that's like, you know, quite difficult work they have to do sort of secondarily after the training is done, or, you know, do various, like, you know, do different variations where you sort of add and remove properties and so on. But yeah, the whole sort of project of like breaking down, like, I guess, like perceptual recognition capacities into like attributes that you would recognize, didn't really get very far. And the kinds of systems that we are familiar with now that have had various degrees of success are generally just based on feeding in a bunch of data and allowing the system to extract patterns that are not really describable in words or like, you know, mathematical equations that you could, you know, say that shape has the, you know, the shape has this equation and therefore it's a face or something like that.
Yeah, here I'm still a little unsure exactly about this section, thematic forms. The ideal that he discusses, I mean, where does this ideal arise? You know, is he saying that? I guess I'm still a little unclear on this, and I don't have any background on Plato, so I don't know. What exactly is he saying here?
Yeah, so the word ideal here comes up in connection with the triangle. Actually, that's a good point. I'm going to check what the French is quickly, because there's actually two different French words that you could translate here. Sorry, give me a second. Okay, yes. Yeah, so the French is idéal, not idéal. Yeah, you might want to, maybe it might be better to translate this as something like ideational or something. I think in like translation of Husserl, I think they translate, they have like separate translations for ideal and ideal, which for him are like technical terms that have different meanings. I can't remember what two words they use, but yeah, so here we have ideal in French, which is not ideal in the sense of like the best or like the goal of some or like the most valuable or whatever. It's ideal in the sense of, you know, belonging to the realm of ideas or having the nature of being an idea or something like that. So I think the point here is that triangle is something that you can, you know, find in the spatial temporal world. You can, you know, look at certain lines of ink on a page or, you know, pencil or whatever. Yeah, or drawn in the sand, as Angus points out. You can see you can identify a triangular form as like a certain you know, arrangement in space, but it also has this sort of abstract quality, or like a triangle is an abstract entity that you can identify, even in the case where like the Canisa triangle that I mentioned, where there's no actual lines on the page at all that are sort of the edges of the triangle. It's sort of like, this is why it's described as an illusion. Illusion maybe is not the right word, but you're sort of perceiving a triangle shape, even though there's no lines that corresponds to that triangle. Here, there's like this abstract form of the triangle that is sort of being recognized in the arrangement on the page. You know, despite the absence of any, you know, arrangement of lines that fits a triangular shape. But yeah, so the triangle is something that has a physical existence in the sense that it or a spatial existence, you know, on this specific piece of paper here in front of me. But it can also be something, a sort of abstract existence that can be identified, you know, even in the absence of those lines.
So essentially that's what he's getting at here, is sort of distinguishing the purely physical from the abstract idea of it, and that the absolute domain is necessary for the latter. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, so maybe if I go back to the example of the chickens and the you know, shade of gray, I think it might be a better example here, because yeah, so you can train the chickens to, you know, always peck the button that is under the lighter shade of gray, you know, a little, you know, emblem that has a lighter shade of gray out of the two shades of gray. You know, you have like two buttons, one under a lighter shade and one under a darker shade, and the chickens can learn that if they press the button that's under the lighter shade, they will get a food reward, and if they press the other one, they don't get anything. And so in this case, the chicken is not responding to like this specific wavelength of, you know, the physical you know, wavelength of light that is striking its retina. It is learning this abstract pattern of lighter than, or, you know, a lighter shade of And so what is sort of guiding the behavior, what the chicken is responding to, is not a physical property of light, but rather a sort of abstract property of this, you know, pair of shades of color. So the chicken is sort of grasping this abstract property, even though, of course, the shade of gray is only sort of realized by reflecting certain wavelengths of light and not others, or, you know, at different degrees of reflectiveness of different wavelengths of light and so on. It's only by, you know, light striking this gray sticker or whatever, and then hitting the eye, the retina of the chicken, that it is capable of, you know, grasping this pattern. But at the same time, the pattern is not itself a sort of physical property of the light.
Okay, so yeah, I think that makes it clear. So it's sort of it's a property that arises, or rather the sense of the property that sort of arises through experience, more or less.
Sense here. Yeah, so in the sense that so a thematic form is like something that can be grasped in experience, or that can guide experience, or that guide behavior, or, you know, some element of the world that you can sort of recognize and act upon, and you here can be, you know, a person, or, you know, in this case, a chicken. So it's this sort of aspect of the world that you can recognize and act upon or respond to, but what you're recognizing is not sort of limited to like a physically describable property of, you know, a spatial temporal arrangement of entities, like, you know, a wavelength of light. Here the chickens are recognizing not my retina is being struck by light of this wavelength, but instead they're recognizing this sticker is lighter than this other sticker. And so, yeah, like in the case of the triangle, they sort of like these two sides sort of, you know, coincide in a sense, but they're still sort of distinct in the sense that, you know, there's a, you know, lines on a page are of course physical entities. There's like, you know, ink that has impregnated certain regions of the page and not others. And, you know, that is what makes up the lines of the on the page. But then this sort of triangular form that you recognize, you can, is a kind of abstract entity because, yeah, you can recognize the triangle, you know, whether it's, you know, black ink on a white page, or it's this sort of white outline left behind by these wedges taken out of the triangle in the illusion, or it could be, you know, drawn on the sand, etc. So you can recognize this triangle form that is not like, it's obviously, it needs a physical sort of medium to be recognizable, but at the same time it's not tied to any one specific physical medium. So I think we can go on to the next bit. Angus, can you read like a page or so?
No problem. B, the possible and the necessary. Oh, that's where we are, right? Yeah, okay. Provisionally substantializing the quote-unquote I unity, we can say that the absolute domain allows quote-unquote modality within behavior, that is, behavior with the sense of the possible and the necessary. We can easily grasp the intimate relation between the immediate possession of a thematic form that has a sense and the behavior according to the possible or the necessary. Consider three itineraries, 1, 2, and 3, between A and B, figure 37. So figure 37 has two points, A and B, and three lines leading from A to B. Number one is just a straight line. 2 and 3 are curved lines on either side of number one. The three itineraries are different as brute facts, but they are quote-unquote equivalent, with identical value and sense, insofar as they equally arrive at point B, considered as the goal, and are equally possible. As quote-unquote step-by-step trajectories, they are absolutely different, just as the different triangular patterns are absolutely different. They are equivalent only in the absolute survey that simultaneously, quote-unquote, sees A, B, and the three trajectories between an infinity of other possible and virtual trajectories starting from A and arriving at B. Let us consider another example, figure 38. Figure 38 is six letters. The top three are I, N, and M. The bottom three are O, A, and B. And O, A, and B, because they have these internal holes, have sort of cuts in the side linking the internal space of the letter to the external space around. I want to cut out capital letters from a piece of cardboard. For I, N, and M, this is straightforward. but I immediately see without needing to try that it is impossible to cut out O, A, or B in the same way, and that it is necessary to leave bridges to hold the inner surface of these letters. C, temporal survey and finality. At the level of the secondary consciousness, there is a dissymmetry between the spatial survey and the temporal survey in absolute means. It is perhaps a matter of a temporary limitation, like the one that barred for so long the access of abstract intelligence to animal consciousness. It is perhaps significant that the authors of great utopian works of science fiction, like Renan, Aldan, and Stapledon, all imagine future humans as rulers of time as well as space. In O. Stapledon's great science fiction, Last and First Men, 1930, the last men, having migrated to Neptune, become masters not only of interstellar space, but also of time. They can act telepathically on the past. They can guide and rescue it. And this is how, our author ingeniously imagines, a Neptunian who will live some millions of years from now is telepathically dictating the tale to him. In the crudely materialist form of telepathy, this play with time is naturally absurd. The Neptunian in question does not saw the branch on which he is seated. He does better. He sows the grain that will become the tree on whose branch he is seated. And yet it is this impossibility that is realized in knowledge history, not materially or psychically, but mentally. As R. Aaron emphasized, there is a recurrence of the present on the past, certainly not through a causal, material, or psychic step-by-step influence traveling backward, but by virtue of the ubiquity of sense. The incidents of the present retrospectively confer a different or variable sense on the incidents of the past. Quote, is the French Revolution finished? Unquote. Corneau wondered. Depending on whether it is finished, its sense is different or could become different, because it is up to us to extend the revolution. Its sense, and hence its historical being, depends on us. When Hitler believed himself triumphant, he said, addressing the dead Germans of Verdun, quote, you fell on the path of great Germany, unquote. And at that precise moment, if he could have stabilized his tentative victory, he would have been right. Once he was vanquished, the deaths became useless again. These historical fluctuations neither warm nor cool the bones that are turning white, but they indisputably alter the sense of Germany's whole previous history. The recurrence of quote-unquote sense in history is tied to the fact that humanity has a continuous life, which surpasses the life of animals, and that in a precarious, yet certain sense, this life is an absolute domain of temporal survey. Yeah, I think both of these are kind of dense sections, maybe starting with modality. So I think, as I understand it, the point is that these paths, 1, 2, and 3, are all possible paths and sort of equivalent as possibilities for a surveying consciousness trying to get from A to B, although they are distinct in terms of their, as step-by-step trajectories. So, you know, you could transpose 3 and 2, but you'd have to transform it to do so. But if you are A and you're trying to, get to the grocery store, different paths to the store are all paths to the store. As possible paths, they're equivalent. I thought this point about impossibility was interesting because it's a kind of task relative impossibility. So it's impossible to, presumably without lifting your, if you're trying to cut continuously, it's impossible to cut out O, A, and capital O, A, and B from a sheet of cardboard without cutting holes into the sides of the letters. But if you took a different approach and you decided you could remove the scissors from the cardboard without doing a continuous cut and then just sort of cut out the interior from the inside of the letter, of course it would be possible. At least as I'm reading this, I don't know if Rouillet would argue that modality is sort of absolute, it can be. It's at least a convincing account of how task-specific modality could be seen as depending on absolute survey. Yeah, the point about the retroactive effect of the present on the past, we've talked many times about melody, the unity of melody, and how the last note can sort of transform the sense of the entire melody that went before. That's only possible if you can hold the whole melody in mind. So, like, obviously the last note doesn't change the physical constitution of the sound waves of the previous notes, but the way the melody is held in mind and experienced in, you know, by the listeners, the way it concludes does change the way that it started.
Yeah, and so you can see, like, this sort of melodic idea, you can see very clearly in this passage how you can think of this in terms of, like, biography of a person, or, you know, historical events over time, etc. Like, you know, there's, like, I think we've talked in previous sessions about how, it might have been in one of the Simon Don sessions, actually, but we were talking about how, like, you can sort of have a project, and you can either achieve or, you know, fail in realizing that project, and that sort of almost retroactively changes the meaning or the value of the earlier stages of the project. So, like, your actions now can sort of bring about, you know, the uselessness or value of what you did, you know, 10, 20 years ago. You can, you know, sort of waste your life by, you know, not by, you know, making a poor decision at one time that sort of retroactively makes everything you did earlier wasted. But of course that doesn't, you know, sort of travel back in time and you know, change what happened in a physical sense. It sort of changes the value or meaning or, you know, utility of what you did. But yeah, it's not a sort of violation of you know, the way the unidirectional flow of time in a physical sense.
Yeah, I think this is starting to bring this together for me. I guess so what he's sort of doing here is, as I understand it, sort of laying out the conditions for sort of like open behavior toward a goal. You know, so that, you know, it's not just a fixed or perfectly predictable pattern of behavior, but that there can be some difference. You know, so, but it's also not just completely random or chaotic. So he's sort of laying out the conditions for sort of semi-bounded creativity, I guess. Here is sort of the way I read it. So that, yeah, I mean, so there can be creativity at every step, but that it also can be achieved towards certain goals.
Yeah, I guess so. You can look at some of these, like, you know, sort of retroactive effect of a later stage. Of course, this is not like purely arbitrary. You can't, like if you've, you know, failed at every step along the way, you can't just sort of at the end, like, you know, kind of reinterpret what you did and say, oh, it actually was a success all along, just by sort of wishing to be a success. You know, you only have open to you certain options, you know, based on what has happened before, what you've done before, sort of where you are now. You can, you know, given that sort of set of constraints, you can, you know, take certain actions or make decisions that affect, you know, what the value of your previous decisions or actions turns out to be. But you can't just sort of arbitrarily open to any kind of, you know, reinterpretation or retroactive revaluation or something. There's like, yeah, it's not just sort of purely arbitrary that you can, you know, give any action any value you want just by, you know, deciding to do so later on.
Yeah, his reference to Hitler here and the German deaths having some temporary meaning and then being useless again. You know, that I think you can't read that without also understanding that Rouillet was a prisoner of war for some time during World War II.
Yeah, this was,
or I, maybe.
Oh, sorry. This wasn't ancient history. This was, yeah. He's writing this, I think, like 1960, somewhere around there. And yeah, so this is like less than 20 years after the, you know, his time as a soldier and a prisoner of war. So yeah, it's something that he knew very well. And of course, you know, if history had turned out differently, then his efforts as a soldier could have ended up being meaningless. You know, if say Germany had won the war, then his, you know, his efforts and possibly his death in the war would have been meaningless. Fortunately, that was not the case. But yeah, like your sort of the result of your efforts, or, you know, the outcome of your efforts at the end, sort of can retroactively, you know, change the value of those efforts, depending on what exactly that outcome is. And this is something that, like, in the case of, like, you know, literary works in particular, I think causes a lot of sort of anxiety for writers sometimes, where it's like there are many writers that will sort of, like, leave instructions to, you know, burn their or destroy their, you know, unfinished works, you know, when they die, or at least there have been people who have done that, or who, you know, themselves destroy things, you know, as they go along, because they don't want to have something, you know, sort of unfinished, or that is not sort of given its, like, value or, you know, overall sort of structure by themselves. So, like, you can't really, like, once you have, you know, released a work into the world, you can't really control what its fate is going to be. And that can sort of, like, retroactively change the value of your, you know, effort and your work in, you know, putting that together, you know, writing that novel or poem or whatever. You know, what it is that you have done can, you know, be affected by, can be changed by, you know, what people make of this work, and you know, who takes it up and so on.
Yeah, with literature, you know, similar to the music, how the end of the piece can shape the meaning of the entirety of the piece. Or I guess to poetry to some degree, but also a lot like with short stories, where the last sentence or two of the story is where, you know, the entire shape of the story arises, or what the meaning within the story was.
Yeah, so like maybe the classic example of this is the occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, you know, a favorite of high school English teachers everywhere, where, yeah, of course, I won't give any spoilers away for anyone who hasn't read it, but the end of the story very much changes the understanding of what came before. You almost have to read it twice to sort of, like, get what's going on, like, reread the earlier parts in light of the end, so that you can sort of figure it out. That's a sort of a common structure in, like, short stories, where you have this, like, final sort of, like, very impactful sort of punchy sentence that sort of makes the whole rest of the story, like, have a different light, sheds a different light on it, or a different coloring on the whole rest of the story. And this is, yeah, like, something that is not, you know, confined to the realm of, you know, literature or art. And, like, so you can think of, you know, someone, in just sort of, like, biography of a person, you know, your decision at one sort of crucial moment can sort of give shape to everything you did before, and, you know, shine a new light on it, and make it either, yeah, the culmination of, you know, a lifetime's worth of effort, or, you know, a sort of, like, throwing away all the work that you had done before, etc. So, yeah, it's this same sort of, like, retroactive effect on the value of what came before is like a general, I think, feature of anything that has to do with, you know, sense or value or something like that. We're at about our 2-hour mark here, so I think we can stop here.
That sounds good. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.